Now, today, North Korea is well known for their provocations, whether it be launching missiles, but back before landing mini submarines, probing the DMZ with troops in the 1960s was sort of a common scene. But how did North Korea first start this infamous legacy after the Korean War? What types of activities made for the first North Korea interventions to attract attention? We'll talk about all that and more here on Made in Korea. This with Professor John DeMoya from Seoul National University, who joins us in the studio. Professor DeMoya, good to see you again.
Thanks very much for having me.
You know, I was saying, you know, big history buff, both of us, and sure. Outside the studio, we're both big sports fans, and I honestly wish we had we have like a second segment where we just talk about the history of sports. You got a Philly guy, you got a guy from Philly, guy from New York City. It calls for a nice sports talk show. Let's just put it at that.
We'd be happy to do it, although I don't think I see it happening.
Well, we're not going to talk sports. Instead, we're going to be talking about North Korea. But it is February, and if you look at history, and mind you, with this particular segment, we like to be sort of timely with the matter here. February 16th, 1958, my dad was 11 days old.
Wow. Okay. It's nice timing.
Something happened where what's interesting about this is, although it's a major event, it's not spoken about too often as much as some of the other incidents.
Correct.
But something happened to a specific South Korean airliner on this very day. Do tell us what happened.
Sure. In a very basic sense, a South Korean airliner that was flying from Busan to Seoul was redirected, rechanneled by some North Korean agents and taken to Pyongyang. As far as I know, you know, there may or may not have been some smaller incidents between the end of the Korean War and then, but this incident usually shows up on these timelines of North Korean provocations with the South. So it seems like this was the first time that people really thought about the idea that getting on a plane that was destined for Seoul might actually be dangerous, and the North Koreans realized, wait a minute, we could actually intervene here, attract attention, take hostages. And ultimately, they do land the plane in Pyongyang. The at least accounts that are out there indicate that of the pilot, one American, two West Germans, and
That's right.
I assume primarily of the rest
South Koreans.
South Koreans. Yes, being Koreans, exactly. Yeah. Most of them were returned, but most of the accounts end with, but eight of them remain. So I assume that was on a hostage basis and not on a voluntary basis. It's a very surprisingly quiet, almost close-ended incident the way it's described. But obviously it sets a precedent for lots of other things that will happen later on.
So again, we talk about almost on a daily basis, you know what, a weekly basis now, that North Korea has some sort of provocation.
Sure.
Again, mostly missile provocations. We've been seeing a lot of cruise missiles, ballistic missiles here and there. But can we say that maybe this was sort of North Korea's first provocation towards South Korea?
That's what I was saying earlier. There may or may not have been smaller things in between 53 and 58, but this one certainly heads almost any list if you do searches on, you know, North Korean attempts to intervene in South Korean affairs. This one almost always appears first. So it seems like, again, that this was one of the first times that roughly 5 years after the ceasefire, but technically still in a state of war, mm-hmm. North Korea thought about, well, wait a minute, we could actually do something like this. And I guess to continue a little further, the only thing that really surprises me is that you don't suddenly see late 50s, early 60s, a spate of such incidents. So it's certainly, if there have been other such incidents, they've been more isolated, and it wasn't like North Korea saw this, it worked, and then it became kind of a blueprint for more frequent activities.
Right.
I think this was just, in some ways, probably a one-off test to see if they could, you know, obviously get the people to board, fake themselves as South Koreans, and then maybe get North Koreans into other aspects of South Korean life less publicly, probably something like that.
Now, mind you, security situations at airports were very
different back then. Sure.
So was this simply basically North Korean spies or agents in South Korea, in Busan, aboard the plane, and decide they're going to hijack it using weapons? Or, like, how did the hijack even go?
That's a good question. The accounts that I have seen do not describe the actual things that they're carrying. But I would assume that they indicated, even if they weren't carrying anything, that they verbally probably said, you know, the usual, we have something, or we have
ways of
obviously divert this plane. And again, the pilot, not knowing at that time probably followed along. But yeah, no, and to your question as well, yeah, I assume these were North Koreans who were passing as South Koreans who were in Busan, who had slated and had been ready and preparing for this to test to see whether they could get on without being detected, and then obviously proceed with the operation.
Now, obviously, we see this until today, in 2024, how two countries narrate certain events very differently.
Absolutely.
I don't know if they really, North Korea sees it differently, or this is what they believe, or,
sure,
you know, it's, again, they're known for propaganda and things like that. But how did the two countries narrate this event differently?
Sure. Obviously, the South Korean account is very much about an act of aggression,
yeah,
if not an act of war. I'm assuming the fact that there were Americans, that being the pilot and one of the passengers, the West Germans. I haven't looked at the German press, but I assume they also were not happy with this.
No.
You know, very much kind of what's going on here, and this being a first time having to find language to frame it. It's the North Korean accounts, which I have to admit, I have not read the Korean, although I'd like to, but even when it's translated English, they use words like liberated, freed, you know, this jet in the kind of war-torn South was escaped, we helped them, you know, come to freedom, this kind of language. And the one thing I'll throw out as a historian, just if you want to give you an analogy, not a lot of people will know it, but it's fun if you ever have a chance.
Yeah.
There is a Japanese historian, still a very senior guy named Wada Haruki, who regularly, as a Japanese kind of Marxist historian, tries to not say what the North Koreans say is true, but try to understand their accounts. And if you ever read his History of the Korean War, which is written from the North Korean perspective, it's mind-blowing, because once you step into that Alice in Wonderland world, if you accept the first five or six premises, you get the whole version of how the North Koreans saw the Korean War. And it's real. So that's, I mean, that kind of thing. The liberation language makes sense if you're willing to grant certain premises.
Does his stance start off with U.S. invaded North Korea and was the beginning of the Korean War?
Something like that, of course. Yeah, of course.
Really? Even as a Japanese scholar, he would
write
something
like that.
He's looking at it at the view of
a... I was just going to say, he is not saying this is historically true. He is saying, this is how my actors see the world. Let's follow along and see what we can learn from this.
So, simply put, you're looking at North Korea basically going, listen, there's a bunch of people, mind you, maybe at this time, South Korea, not the kind of... very far from the South Korea we see right now.
Yes, very... 5 years after the war, Syngman Rhee, right-wing, somewhat impoverished... From their perspective, they also are in recovery, but they are probably more advanced.
Right.
And I definitely want to be clear and make sure I'm not saying it's true, but I'm saying that is their viewpoint.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're basically going, listen, we only did what they were afraid to do. I'm sure that if they had the chance, they would have wanted to escape to North Korea and be in this great capital of Pyongyang.
And in a weird and interesting way, to make the analogy historians love to do, this language looks a little bit like, of course, it's a couple of years later, I think, when the Berlin Wall goes up, but similar in kind of narration when people jump across the wall. Obviously, the West Germans, another one has come over the wall. The East Germans, another one has been perverted by the capitalist world or something like that.
And
is very much the tensions of the Cold War.
And obviously, South Korea is going to call... I mean, it was a hijack. And that's
exactly
what it was.
I mean, it's a hijack.
They're not going to say anything else. I mean, it was a hijack. I mean, they have hostages, and we need to deal with this issue. But what kinds of incidents happened between North Korea and South Korea at this time? Because to me, it just kind of seems like they went from... Again, we don't know if there were little provocations here and there.
Sure.
It's hard to kind of record all that, but... it's a big jump. And you compare that even with a missile provocation nowadays. It's a big thing to hijack a plane.
I can't say, as I said, for whether there are any small minor incidents before then, but if you do some quick looking and some quick searching, what comes up almost immediately after is a couple other incidents with airplanes, not hijackings, but the shooting down of an American plane over the DMZ, and then that's in later in 58, and then I believe it's 60 or 61, the shooting of an American helicopter near the DMZ.
Oh, they're going really at it at 58.
So just reading these together, some kind of sharp sense of the North Korean airspace, them becoming aware of the fact that this is something they need to deal with, and presumably performatively indicate that we're willing to defend this and we're willing to handle it in certain kinds of ways.
I mean, it just seems like a very brazen move.
Oh, I agree. But again, given the context of the time, they're probably... I mean, I'm guessing that with the hijacking, obviously the return of most of the passengers, that there wasn't an escalation, and that as they do now, presumably North Koreans are looking exactly, how does the other side respond? How can we... if this response doesn't frighten us or doesn't discourage us in a major way, kind of where can we, how can we go with the next ante? How can we up the ante?
And the craziest thing out of all this, and this is where I want to ask you how the U.S. and South Korea responded to this event, is because in normal cases, again, I mean, you're only about, what was it, 5 years after the ceasefire.
July, this is just under 5 years.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And so, I mean, you would assume that this could have easily triggered another major conflict.
This could have been a problem, yes.
But again, we talk about how this hasn't really been talked about. How did U.S., first and foremost, U.S. passenger on this, West Germany, there was a West German passenger, there was an American passenger. How did the U.S. respond to this incident?
Okay, as far as I can tell, the U.S. did not take this to any of the things like the commission connected to the end of the war.
Oh, wow.
I believe there was a negotiation essentially over how quickly can we get these passengers back and what do we need to do. And it sounds like the ones that were returned was something in the range of about a week, that it was fairly quickly.
Sure.
I suspect in their own case, the North Koreans probably were not prepared at that point in time to harbor long-term. Famously also, sort of less well-known as well, but if you know, famously there are four
American soldiers
that go over in the early 60s. So yeah, they hadn't yet gotten to the point where they had long-term foreigners that came over, with the exception of anyone left over from the Korean War. So probably they were, I suspect on all sides, this was probably somewhat experimental in terms of planning, executing, and then also reacting. They were very much learning each other's language, learning each other's kind of moves, and figuring out what to do.
What about the South Korean side? How did the South
Koreans
respond to
this? Well, that's interesting, because I'm glad that, I mean, I think we can confirm that the 24 passengers are South Korean, but a lot of the accounts, and I'm not sure why this is, in English will say other passengers.
Okay.
Now, I don't know whether that's just sensitivity to the fact that the South Korean government doesn't want to kind of emphasize that, or whether they had the South Koreans of a particular kind of role. But in any case, my guess is that with the usual, status of forces things, I suspect the U.S. probably led, at least in terms of the negotiations with the North Koreans.
My thing is, we're talking about 1958, mm-hmm. okay? Even the fact that there's airplanes going back and forth from Busan to Seoul is one thing, right? I can understand back then they didn't have the expressways that they had. And so
an airplane was not until 70s.
No, that's way later on. So for those that are pretty much very privileged.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If you're on a plane in 58 and you're South Korean, you're presumably fairly wealthy, if not government connected or something. Yeah, you're not an average person.
Yeah, and so my thing is, for those South Koreans that are aboard this plane, the fact that there's no identity on who they are, the fact that they just call them other passengers, they must have been somebody, right? Whether it be government
and
officials.
That's why I'm wondering why that it says other passengers in a way to kind of keep it. I read that more as just desire not to be any further information about it.
And that could be it, right?
Yeah.
So like for example, let's say they're from like a very wealthy family and they don't want the media attention, or
precisely,
they don't want to kind of be.
Or I was thinking possibly soldiers or someone where it's embarrassing the fact that they got taken up to Pyongyang.
Oh, that could be possible as well. This is just insane how something like this could happen. And for it to just kind of not blow up into something even bigger here, because negotiations happen. Now, did the hostages eventually, they were all sort of released?
Yeah, I have not followed up what happens to the eight, that it usually says they stayed a little bit longer, but I assume that was only for a period of time. But the initial group, yes, comes back very quickly.
So you kind of have to wonder, right? So there must have been something where North Korea was like, it's too big of a move for them to just kind of go, all right, here we go.
No, I agree. I agree.
There
has to be something leveraged. And again, this doesn't, I mean, I didn't dig deeply, but at least in the initial press accounts, particularly English language, this does not appear. So yes, there has to be other things that are just not in the initial press coverage. The other thing that I wanted to say really quickly off the cuff, just as when I first read about this, I kept thinking, wow, why didn't this become the trope of the early 70s? Take this plane to Cuba, take this plane to Pyongyang.
Yeah.
Now, there are a few incidents, and the one that's really famous is March 70, where the Japanese Red Army students group actually do hijack a plane. I think it's to, I can't remember if it was Fukuoka to Seoul or the other way around, but they end up landing in Seoul and then moving on to Pyongyang. And the reason it's famous is some of the Japanese, including, I'm sorry, I can't resist this, Moriaki Wakabayashi, who is a member of a Japanese noise band, he's the bass player, they end up being in North Korea like the next 40 years because they're Japanese left wingers, you know, against U.S. militarism.
Right, right.
They think like Cuba. But anyway, this doesn't become a thing, though, other than these occasional Japanese students or things like that. Taking a plane to Pyongyang doesn't become the trope that it could have become with this first incident.
Yeah, and I just feel like this is one of those things, and again, what we're going to call one of the major provocations from North Korea.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's just amazing that it didn't become more of a precedent in my mind.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in just a bit. And it does seem like you said, it was kind of North Korea's way of going, let's see how far we can do this without causing a conflict, a major armed conflict.
Precisely.
And then that set a precedent for what we see right now, because, I mean, yes, you have all these, you have ballistic missile tests, you have submarine ballistic missile tests, we have these cruise missiles, they're testing nuclear weapons later on. And so what you have is UN Security Council resolutions that sanction them here and there. But the big question is, how effective has these UN Security Council have been for the government, right? Like, a lot of people are saying it hurt the people more.
Yeah,
the
in
government.
Terms of lack of access to food, resources.
Oh, absolutely. And so, I mean, Kim Jong-un is still very much nourished, and his people are getting
at
all the German cars.
At least when he makes a public appearance, he does not look like he's missing any some substantive meals.
No, he does not. And so it's kind of their way of going, listen, we're getting away with this.
I was just going to say, you know, I do not work this contemporary, but a lot of people have talked about this. These are a rhetoric, a form of communication, as crude as that is. And it is put out a message, see what the response is, change the message a little bit, see what the response is. This is a way of getting attention. This is a way of creating it. For better or worse, it is a form of dialogue.
Let's talk about how this incident is sort of connected to later provocations,
sure,
too, though.
I do think it sets, well, as we said, it's not a precedent in and of itself,
yeah,
but certainly most famously by the early to mid 60s with the border incidents in the DMZ, it does set up a regular pattern. First, as I mentioned, those two planes shot down, one in 58, one at about 60, 61. Again, these are U.S. military vehicles.
Yeah, yeah.
But then later of regular provocations into the DMZ by about 65, 66. And this has larger connections to the Vietnam War. This has connections to North Korea really wanting to probe and really wanted to see what are the parameters and capabilities of the South Korean defense system. Yeah, how far do we have to go before we get a response? Let's see what we can do.
Actually, even with the American helicopter,
yes,
and the American plane being shot down, to me that's baffling, the fact that the Americans didn't really respond,
sure,
harshly with this. And it was kind of, again, something that I'm learning for the first time here, maybe because it's just not talked about enough.
No, this,
I don't know
this
why.
Also was relatively new to, I mean, this particular incident is relatively new to me.
So is it sort of like, because, you know, at this time still, the U.S. is probably making all the shots. You know, they're calling all the
I
shots
I would
here.
Think so, given the status of forces, or at least in consultation with.
And they're going, let's not delve ourselves into a second Korean war. We need to avoid as much conflict as
think
possible.
I would think that would be the response. Again, I've not seen what the dialogue is, but I would imagine everything would be about, let's take care of this as quickly as we can.
And so we talked about other things previously in our previous episode of all the brazen things that North Korea has done,
sure,
including, of course, the Blue House situation.
Yes, which comes in 68. Yeah.
Right. And so even that is sort of a way. If anybody else sees this in now times, if North Korean soldiers came in.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Sure.
But back then, we were talking about it. And I really like the perspective that you put in with the U.S. at the time, because you were saying at the time, there was the Vietnam War going on. There was many of these South Korean troops were assisting the Americans in Vietnam. And so there was a lack of soldiers, but also the U.S. just could not deal with South Korea at the time because of Vietnam. And so North Korea,
they have to know that at some level. Exactly.
Oh, they know
exactly,
what's happening,
exactly.
But they quote unquote let that slide by.
Sure.
Because I could almost see Park Chung-hee going, you try to take my life. It's war again. But
sure,
it kind of slid. It was nothing happened.
Yeah,
afterwards.
Yeah. And nicely, I mean, to go back to this incident, I have not seen anything in any of the press accounts about President Lee Sung-mun said this is a response, or because obviously it didn't affect him personally, but nonetheless, he must have had.
But Lee Sung-mun has such close ties with the United States.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He must have had something to say privately, I'm sure.
I want to know this. I mean, there was a number of Korean airline incidents.
Yes, coming up later, but the
later
famous
on,
83 one. Yeah.
Yeah, 83 one was very famous,
absolutely,
right? And so when this subject was brought in by a writer during our staff meeting, I said, mm-hmm, what are you talking about? I've Never heard of it. You're talking about when the bombing of the Korean
That also comes up when you do a search. You get other dates, not this one. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I didn't understand why this incident hasn't become more famous in the history of this clash between the two Koreas.
I also do not know. And I think that's an absolutely great question. And I have to offer the unfortunate historian's answer, which it's really interesting. And I'd like to think about it more.
And I feel, you know, one of the things that we try to avoid as much as possible is conspiracy theories.
Sure, no.
Right? But then conspiracy theories sort of come from certain facts that also back it up, right? And there's a reason why certain conspiracy theories come up. And to me, this just seems like, again, not my opinion or anything like mm-hmm. that, but just from what we've seen with the Blue House raid and with this, is it kind of the U.S. going, hey, bury it? No questions asked. We got our hostages back, and we don't want any further clashes with North Korea. We just can't afford to do that right now.
I'll go more with even that it was so new and so novel that no one just knew how to digest it. And for whatever reasons, North Korea decided not to, let's repeat this or have a kind of follow-up.
I'm trying to look up who was the, I don't know if you know on the top of your head who mm-hmm. the U.S. president was.
Oh, 58? Eisenhower.
Eisenhower.
Yeah.
So for Eisenhower, what kind of decision would he have made?
That's I only thing, know that right? he's the one who famously goes and says, I will get us out of Korea. So I imagine he doesn't want any
conflict there.
That's my reading of it.
And so already right off the bat, right? Although you have a number of presidents who follow certain presidents who got themselves in the war, the first thing they say is we'll get them out of war, right?
Sure.
We had that with Iraq, and we had that with, you know, all sorts of things. But it's just fascinating to me that we always talk about the severity of these provocations that North Korea has been conducting. But you look back decades ago, I mean, it's just beyond.
Yeah. And also, to me, it fascinates me as a historian that other historians have not latched onto this as you're saying, just as a topic of discussion. It's usually the earliest stuff that pops up is the DMZ stuff in the early to mid 60s. That's why this one is such a weird, interesting outlier, and I'm not quite sure what to make of it.
Which brings up conspiracy theories.
Okay, I'm not going to go there because professionally I can't do that. Honestly, the more I said, my baseline answer would be something that it was just such a novel experience that people were very quickly, kind of like if you put yourself in the minds of the actors, North Koreans like, wow, we got away with that one. Let's not go there again for a while. Let's digest that. And the Americans are probably sure like, okay, let's ramp up airport security, South Koreans as well. Let's be more careful. But also, again, I think this probably might have even been an experiment to how many North Koreans can we get within South Korean society in other capacities? Not necessarily airliners, but what can we do in other ways that we can influence their society?
Yeah, and just...
And of course, the trope of North Korean spies has been around, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And just the idea of how quickly the hostages were released,
yes.
The passengers were released, and
the fact that this did not turn into a month long.
Oh, no.
Exactly.
And so it was kind of North Korea going, hey, we know how far we can go. Let's kind of bury this.
And we also know enough that we know what their security apparatus is like should we need to slide someone into the system again.
Yeah, and there's been a number of incidents later on where North Korean spies take a huge role. And, of course, there are – maybe we'll talk about some of the more renowned North Korean spies that were arrested in South Korea. But – fascinating stuff. Professor Des Moines, I mean, this is one of those things where, again, you learn only in made it Koreas, I want to put it. I want to thank you very much for coming in today,
as
always, for
our
history lesson. Have a safe rest of the week, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks very much.
You can listen to Korea Now with me, SJ Lee, by downloading the Arirang Radio application or tune in online by visiting www.arirangradio.com. So make sure you tune in Mondays through Fridays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Korea time.